Listen to WGN Radio's newest podcast, Behind the Badge, Illinois, hosted by David Hochberg. Behind the Badge, Illinois views current events through the eyes of Illinois law enforcement leaders. Tune in. Visit WGNradio.com/behindthebadge.
All right, welcome to a special edition of the Dave Plyer Show, The Groovy 60s, right here on 720 WGN. Television cemented its grip on American attention spans during the 1960s with memorable sitcoms, dramas, westerns, and variety shows, shows that have stood the test of time for more than half a century. The 60s were also a time of upheaval in society, fashion attitudes, and especially in music with the Beatles, the Rolling Stones, the Beach Boys, the Who, the Doors, the Kinks, and the Monkees. So tonight, let's look at some of the greatest 60s TV shows that graced the small screen, provided some escape, and made us laugh. Plus, we'll highlight two legendary rock bands that made history. We'll feature my conversations with music icons Mike Love of the Beach Boys and the legendary Mickey Dolenz of the Monkees. We'll also talk to TV legends Barbara Eden of I Dream of Jeannie, the late Adam West of Batman, Bill Mumy from Lost in Space, the late Don Wells of Gilligan's Island, TV producer George Schlatter on the groundbreaking show Laugh-In, and a comedy legend who, with his brother, helmed one of the most controversial shows of the late 1960s, and that is Dick Smothers of the Smothers Brothers. First up is the legendary Mike Love of the Beach Boys. Grammy winner and Rock and Roll Hall of Fame member Michael Edward Love grew up under the California sun, where he soaked up a life of music, surf, sand, and sport. Beginning his singing career as a young boy, Mike, along with his cousin Brian Wilson, frequently sang at family get-togethers and holiday gatherings. These early influences served as the inspiration to form the legendary group The Beach Boys, which originally consisted of Mike and his cousins Brian, Dennis, and Carl Wilson, along with neighbor David Marks and high school friend Al Jardine. The Beach Boys will forever have an unmistakable feel-good sound of the summer.
Wouldn't it be nice if we were older, then we wouldn't have to wait so long? And wouldn't it
hey, Dave.
Be nice
to... Thanks for having me on the program.
Absolutely. Oh, man, I'm thrilled to be talking to you. I am a huge, huge fan. And what always intrigues me about you guys is there is a love for the Beach Boys music that has been unmatched and has crossed 3 to 4 generations.
Well, you're quite right about that, and 3 to 4 oceans too.
What are the early origins of the Beach Boys? You and the Wilson boys were cousins, and you hung out a lot as kids, and you sang together.
A tremendous amount, actually. Every holiday, Thanksgiving, Christmas, Easter, any birthday or anything, it always music was the central focus of any celebration that we would have as a family. And when my mother came to California along with her siblings, they were so poor. They came from Dust Bowl conditions in Kansas. My father's side came from rural Louisiana, at least my grandfather Love did. And these people, they didn't have any money, but they had music, especially the Wilson side of the family. My mom sang on the radio in the 1930s. Mm.
Wow.
It was a big deal. So music wasn't because we never went into music thinking we'd become famous or you know, make any money at it. We just love creating those harmonies together, and those harmonies are what distinguishes the Beach Boys from so many other groups. And it's because of the love of the music, nothing else.
Well, you did this for family fun. It was really family mm-hmm. get-together. So where did the idea come about that, hey, let's actually formalize this, let's create a band? How did that come about?
Well, my cousin Dennis and I would go fishing off the Redondo Beach breakwater, and we would talk, and we started talking about surfing, which I'd go with my high school friends. If the surf is up, we'd miss a few afternoon classes, to be honest. And we'd drive down to the beach and have a great time. And so surfing preceded the Beach Boys. You know, it was our high school experience growing up in Southern California. And that gave rise, that whole environment, you know, just living a few miles away from the beach, gave rise to the idea of doing a song about surfing. Because there's this whole cult around surfing, the way you dress, the way you, some of the words you would use, and just your attitude in life and stuff. It was all like a little mini subculture mm-hmm. there in Southern California. So we decided to make up a song about it, and That was our first record called Surfing. Our second one was Surfing Safari. Third one was Surfing USA. So each year, 1961, 2, and 3, each year the whole phenomenon grew. And very quickly in the early to mid-60s, the Beach Boys became world-renowned.
So you create the song Surfin', and Candix Records, which was an independent label, released the song, but now under the Beach Boys. So how did you go from the Pendletones to the Beach Boys?
A fellow named Russ Regan, who was a record promotion man at the time and eventually became the head of a couple of big major record companies, he actually is the one who named us that. Pendleton Mills made these kind of woolen shirts that were plaid that you would wear over your T-shirt when you're at the beach to keep warm. So the surfers all wore the Pendleton shirts, Pendleton Mills. Mm-hmm. So we called ourselves the Pendletones. You know, but that didn't stick, because when we heard Surfing by the Beach Boys, we said, well, that's better than what we got. We eagerly adopted the term the Beach Boys. And it made sense, because, you know, we're all from that Southern California environment. Dennis Wilson and I and Al Jardine, we all had our surfboards. And were we good surfers? That's debatable.
Okay.
But we were part of that culture, you know, part of that Southern California culture. It became the very cornerstone of our success.
In the very beginning, how did you all decide who was going to do what exactly with the band?
I would sit down and write music with my cousin Brian. So he would sit at the piano. I would stand beside him with a notebook or some paper, and we would figure out the songs. He would come up with the chord progressions primarily. I would come up with the lyrics and the concepts. So because I was sitting there with him writing the songs, it fell to me a lot of songs to sing the lead. So whether it be Surfing Safari or Surfing USA or California Girls or I Get Around or Fun, 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 any of those songs, I would sing the lead because we were writing them together. Mm-hmm. So he would be banging them out. I'd be singing along and I'd be coming up with the words or the hooks, like Round, Round, Get Around, I Get Around. I came up with that. So because he and I wrote them together, it fell to me to sing the lead on many of them. Of course, on the ballads, he would take the high part.
Sure.
I would take the low part, and Carl and Alan would be in between on something like In My Room or Surfer Girl or that kind of thing.
And, you know, you're performing again, Family Functions. You're now recording music. Do you remember that first time you hit the stage that, you know, you were a paid performer, like on a big act? Was that in 1961? When was that?
New Year's Eve, December 31st, 1961, New Year's Eve. We were on a show at Long Beach Municipal Auditorium, a Ritchie Valens Memorial Dance and Show. And on the show was Ike Turner and the Kings of Rhythm. Tina Turner was an Ikeette. They blew my mind. What a groove they got into. And there were other acts on the show, such as the Rivingtons, who had a song called Papa Umau Mau, which we actually covered. We recorded it on our live album a couple years later. But yeah, that was the first time that, I mean, we did three songs. We got paid $300. And I thought, hey, this is pretty good. $60 for the five of us.
Wow.
$60 for three songs. That's pretty good. And so nowadays we look at Baddock on it and it's hilarious, you know, but at that point in time, we were nervous. We weren't sophisticated. We hadn't been on stage that many times, maybe at a high school, you know, assembly or something.
Sure.
But yeah, that was the first time that I remember being on a show. And that's the night I made the decision, well, I'm not going to be nervous anymore, because that's just, you know, affecting me. So I'm just going to go out and do the best I can. That's going to have to be good enough.
For 55 years almost, exactly. We are talking to the legendary Mike Love of the Beach Boys, and there's more when we get back on 720 WGN.
Surfing USA.
He released the second single, Surfin' Safari, back with 409, and soon thereafter you signed with Capitol Records, and Surfin' USA came out. Was that the song, Surfin' USA, that really got you national attention? Was that the big one?
Yeah, it showed up in the charts in Israel, South Africa, Australia, Philippines, all over Scandinavia. But it turns out surfing is very close to serpent, which means drinking. So it was a drinking safari or drinking USA.
People love that, I'm sure.
to some people, yeah. I mean, it worked.
That's awesome. Now, I know the Beatles were on the Sullivan Show in 64, also on Capitol Records. It doesn't seem like they really made a big impact at all on what you guys were doing here because the hits just kept coming.
Well, it was an impact because they were so tremendously popular, and it was like an explosion of popularity. But right, like I was saying earlier, that in 1966 we had Good Vibrations. We were voted the number one group in Great Britain. So even at the height of Beatlemania stuff, the Beach Boys did. We were awed by their success and their creativity, as they were ours. The Pet Sounds album. It really blew a couple of minds, and John Lennon and Paul McCartney. They listened to it, and Paul said, "Oh my! What are we going to do?"
That's awesome.
So they got busy with the Sgt. Pepper's, and in Rolling Stone magazine, they had a coffee table of the top 500 albums of all times or something, and number one is Sgt. Pepper's, and number two is Pet Sounds.
Yeah, exactly.
So I demand a recount.
Nice. Well, then, I Get Around came up. Fun was the other one. And I know I've heard you quoted as saying this, that you might have sang fun now for like the 6,000th time.
Probably. Close to it. I mean, we've done at least 5,500 shows over the last 55 years. So it's very likely that we have done it because that was, one of the earlier big singles. And we close our show with it. And I like to leave the people leaving them think the concerts thinking fun. They had fun
when they came to see him.
So,
absolutely.
To me, that's pretty important. That's the whole idea about our show, is to create some positivity. And sure, we have some melancholy stuff, like if we'll sing The Warmth of the Sun or In My Room. But there's some upbeat, real fun songs, Help Me, Rhonda, I Get Around, Fun, Surfing USA, all those.
Oh, they're all upbeat. You can't help but feel good when you listen to the music.
And that's the idea, because I've always called what we do a sonic oasis. There's a lot of problems in the world, a lot of problems in personal lives, and for a period of time to either play a song, play an album, or come to a concert, we don't avoid emotion, that's for sure, because we've all experienced it, and we put it into our songs, God Only Knows, and that kind of thing. But I think the music should be to uplift and entertain and bring happiness. That's my, I like to accentuate the positive, even if something isn't fantastic.
Yeah.
You can usually find something good about whether it was falling out of love with somebody, or somebody didn't love you anymore. At least you had felt that feeling at one time. So there's a whole range of emotions that Beach Boys music touches upon, and I think we've gotten nothing but great positive feedback over the years from so many thousands
sure.
of people.
Absolutely. Well, even California Girls that came out, the song was included in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame songs that shaped rock and roll. I mean, and so many of your songs are noted in the history from, Rolling Stone magazine and all these, that it just has the most incredible impact on music in general.
Yeah, I know. We're very blessed that a family hobby would become a profession, and a long-lasting one at that.
Yeah, yeah.
1966, though, that's 50 years ago, and what a year. Barb ran in the early part of the year, big hit.
Yeah.
Pet Sounds released, Good Vibrations in the fall. I mean, that's quite a year.
You did so many live albums, too. You did the first live album ever to hit number one. In 1970, you guys signed a contract with Reprise, released a double album, The Beach Boys in Concert, that went gold. Your live albums were huge.
Well, you know what it is? The Beach Boys live, I mean, that's where it's at. I mean, records are great and radio's great and having your songs and soundtracks is wonderful. And it's all good. But the experience of a live concert where the music is being performed by the group that was involved in making it, and the energy between the audience and the performers is amazing.
And throughout your career, you've co-authored, you know, more than a dozen top 10 singles, cementing the Beach Boys' legacy alongside the Beatles and Michael Jackson as the only artist to have produced 12 top 10 singles within 5 years. You amassed 35 top 40 tunes. 8 of your first 10 albums landed among the top 10, still performing over 150 sold-out shows a year all over the world. It's American music history made right here, and the story continues. And that is the legendary Mike Love. It's the Groovy 60s on the Dave Plyer Show. Mickey Dolenz of the Monkees is coming up after the news next here on 720 WGN. Hey, Plyer on 720 WGN. Our flashback to the 1960s continues with Mickey Dolenz of the Monkees. In the fall of 1965, Mickey was one of 400 applicants who responded to a trade ad that announced auditions for a new TV show about a rock band. He auditioned for the Monkees TV show by playing and singing Chuck Berry's legendary rocker, Johnny B. Goode. And he wound up chosen for the show along with three other actors, Davy Jones, Michael Nesmith, and Peter Tork. The Monkees' debut single, Last Train to Clarksville, featured Mickey on lead vocals, hit the charts in 1966 and rocketed swiftly to number one. 2 days later, the television show debuted on NBC to great success. TV ratings remained high for two seasons. The show won an Emmy Award for that first season for Outstanding Comedy Series. And now back to the 60s with the legendary Mickey Dolenz.
Hey, hey, we're the Monkees. And people say we monkey around. But we're too busy singing.
Wow, what an intro. You should introduce my show with me on the road.
I'd love to. Well, I mean, honestly,
you're
just somebody I have really grown up with and have been able to, you know, see you generationally since I was a kid. Like, I was thrilled to see you perform in 2011 with Peter and Davy. It was the 45th anniversary tour. It was my kids' first concert ever. And I got to tell you, yeah, it was their first concert ever. And I got to tell you, you sound better than ever, my friend.
Well, thank you. I work at it. I train. I try to take care of myself, and I work on keeping my voice in shape. You know, you have to when you do that many kind of concerts. I actually started a formal training kind of late in life when I started doing Broadway musicals, and you know, that's 8 shows a week, and some of them require a lot of big singing. And so touch wood. You know, my parents were also singers, and so I learned from them. And I think, frankly, a little bit of it for sure is genetic. You know, but I'm hanging in there.
Well, I was going to say, you came from genetically from a family of entertainers. Your mom and dad were both in the business.
Both singers, both actors. Yep, my mom played piano. My dad sang light opera, that kind of stuff. My mom was a big band singer and sang, you know, Billie Holiday bluesy, you know, kind of stuff too. And my sister and I, we grew up. My sister does the show with me; she'll be there.
Cool.
We grew up absolutely in a showbiz family. It wasn't your typical sort of Hollywood Beverly Hills showbiz family. We lived out on a ranch with horses and chickens and
cool. And
stuff. And then, as you probably know, I had that series when I was a kid called Circus Boy.
Yeah, that wasn't any local production. I mean, that series ran on NBC and ABC. That was a big deal.
Oh, it was a network show, yeah, like the Monkees. In fact, it was the exact same studio.
No way.
Yeah, absolutely. Screen Gems Television, it was called at the time. Now it's Sony TV. It was Screen Gems Television, and it was, as you say, NBC, and the same network that the Monkees showed on. And both of them took place almost exactly 10 years to the day. I went for an audition for Circus Boy when I was 10 years old at Screen Gems in Hollywood, and I went for the audition for the Monkees when I was 20 years old.
Wow.
And it would have been in the pilot season exactly 10 years later. In fact, when I drove up for the Monkee audition to the gate, the barred gate thing, the guy, the guard there at the gate said, "Hey, Mickey, you're coming back."
That's great.
He'd been the same guy that was there when I was doing
circus.
That's
fantastic. That is awesome. Now, is that something, Mickey, that you wanted to do because you've seen your parents do it, or was it something they kind of pushed you into? Like, how did you get on the show? Like, what propelled you?
A good question. I was definitely not pushed into anything. I mean, I almost didn't even go to the Circus Boy audition because I had a baseball game. It was simply kind of following in my parents' footsteps, my father's footsteps, shall we say, but absolutely no pressure. My mom and dad, they were definitely not, my mom was definitely not a stage mom. You know, eyes and teeth, honey, eyes and teeth. I didn't have any training except watching my dad do it and my mom sing and my dad act, and but no stage school or anything like that. I just basically followed in my father's footsteps. You know, it was the family business. I got lucky, of course, with Circus Boy, but I'd already done a couple of screen tests even before that. So after Circus Boy, my parents took me out of the business very wisely, because those are the tricky years, you know, for a child star. You know, after you're big and famous, and then all of a sudden at 14 you're a has-been.
Yeah.
So those, they wisely took me out.
Very smart.
And back to school, back to regular school. And then after high school, I started to dabble. I'll tell you frankly, I went to college to be an architect.
Yeah, I read that. Yeah.
Yeah, I was going to be an architect, and if I couldn't make it as an architect, I'd fall back on showbiz. And then
not a bad deal,
I was into architectural drafting for at least a year or so or more, and when the Monkey audition came along, and I wasn't a fool. I knew the power of a series, and of course, and but no, my plan was actually to be an architect. So no, I had an agent, you know, and so I went to a proper private audition, and then and it was extensive, those auditions. Boy, I'll never forget. It was way, way more extensive than a normal television series auditions, you know, where normally you'd go in and read, maybe get a call back, and maybe have a screen test. But in this case, there was acting and singing and playing an instrument and improvisation and scene study. And, you know, they clearly had in mind that they wanted us to you had to be able to sing and play to get through even the first audition. You had to be able to do that. So clearly they had in mind that they were going to hopefully, if the thing went on the air and it did well, that we'd go on the road. You know, the closest thing I think's come along in a while that was similar in paradigm would be something like Glee, where it's a TV show about this imaginary Glee Club, but they can all do it. They're very talented. They can sing, they can act, they can dance, they can do it all. In fact, I understand they go on the road, too, if I'm not mistaken.
But the one thing is, none of them really knew each other before they all got together to work together, and that's kind of what this was. Although, all of you had musical backgrounds, but y'all played different things, and they kind of looked at you as, you know, playing what it looked like on screen rather than you actually knew how to play it. So how long did it take producers to actually allow you guys to play together?
Well, that's a real long story. You know, a couple of documentaries even been made about it. Yeah. No, when we were hired, as it were, they said, "You're the drummer." I said, "Cool, where do I start?" And I started to learn. They had already started recording stuff before they even hired us, because they had to for the production of the television show. Frankly, I wasn't that bothered one way or the other. I understood, you know, the business and Hollywood and television and stuff. Mike and Peter, especially Mike, I think were very... well, they've gone on record saying, Mike especially, he was very disappointed. You know, they had led him to believe, so he says, that he would be able to sing and write and record his own music. And the thing snowballed so quickly that I think it sort of got ripped out of everybody's hands, you know, at a very, very early age. And we had our palace revolt, as you may have heard, and we won the right to at least have something to say. we had nothing to say about the early recordings, not who was going to write them, who was going to sing them, who was going to play on them, which ones would be released.
Right.
You know, we didn't even have approval of album covers. So that changed, you know, after the first two albums, which, by the way, I'm very proud of the first two albums. I mean, they're huge, and there was wonderful, wonderful material written by the likes of Boyce and Hart and Carol King and Neil Diamond and, you know, huge, wonderful writers and great songs. And then the third album was Headquarters, which we decided to do entirely ourselves, and I'm really fond of that album, too. It's not a bad album at all. And that's just literally the four of us. I mean, we even did the catering.
Yeah. That's cool.
That first year, we sold more albums and singles than supposedly the Beatles and the Stones combined. But, the power of television and the show just resonated. But it isn't one thing. You know, people ask me, what was the secret of the success? And there is no secret. There's no formulas. If there were, there'd never be a flop. But you surround yourself with, you know, talented people and people that share your vision, and you work hard, and you hopefully avoid the pitfalls and the mistakes. And then the way I look at it is that one day, the whole just becomes greater than the sum of its parts. One of the producers asked many years later, what was the secret to success? He said, we just caught lightning in a bottle. And I think you can say that about, any successful endeavor, like a TV show or a movie or a song or a play. You just all of a sudden, it kind of ignites, and I don't think you can reduce it in any way and say, oh, well, it was just the TV show, or oh, it was just the writing, or it was just the singing, it was just the acting.
It was everything.
It's everything. And like I say, the whole becomes greater than the sum of its parts, and it just takes off.
Dave Plyer on 720 WGN, and we're talking to the legendary Mickey Dolenz of the Monkees. Mickey, long before MTV, the Monkees really pioneered the music video.
Yeah, we didn't call them music videos. They were called romps.
Was that right?
and we called them the romp. And every script had a romp in it, or two sometimes. And that was to have footage to do something over the song, the new song that was going in the show that week.
Right. But then you had to go on tour. I mean, at some point during all this, you're doing TV, you're doing the music and recording albums, and now, hey, we're hitting the road and we're going out in concert. I mean, that was a big deal.
Well, again, as you said, that had never been even attempted before in exactly the same way. But all, there had been a little crossover. Look at Ricky Nelson, He recorded, he had songs out, but not to the level and not to the degree that the Monkees did. It was a really concerted effort, by the record company and the television company and the radio stations. But that was the plan. It had been the plan all along. Otherwise, they wouldn't have bothered to cast guys that could sing and play.
Sure,
they would have just faked the whole thing and for whatever, a very Hollywood, sort of tradition, which it was done for decades. So they obviously had in mind they wanted us to eventually get on the road. It was interesting. I had months to practice the drums. I was a guitar player, as you know, and I said, I'm a guitar player, and they said, yeah, but we have enough guitar players, so you're the drummer. And I, my attitude of going into a Hollywood television series, I was sure, great, where do I start? And then the next day I started drum lessons, kind of like similar to Circus Boy, when they said you're gonna be the Circus Boy on NBC and you're gonna ride an elephant. And I said,
and
I said, great, where do I start?
Yeah, exactly.
and I had elephant riding lessons.
Wow. Let's talk about your drumming style a little bit. It is so unique, and I love when you play the drums on stage.
Well, thank you. I have great fun doing it. I'm okay at what I do. I'm certainly not any kind of a session pro session drummer. You know, I never had to play anything that I hadn't already recorded. Mm-hmm. But I love playing, and I do love playing. I play a little weird, you know, it's kind of backwards, the setup. And I played even on this latest album we did, Good Times. And I do love playing. When we do monkey shows, I play.
You do everything.
A lot. But when I do a solo show, I don't tend to, because over the years, you know, us singing drummers do tend to come down more often and sing up downstage, because frankly, you know, it's like it's pretty boring to go to a concert and not be able to see the lead singer who's
right.
sitting behind
a bunch
of cymbals.
Yeah, right.
So I talked to Phil, you know, in the past, and I've talked to Ringo, and you know, it's inevitable. If you're singing the lead, people want to see you downstage singing the lead.
And speaking of the Beatles, I mean, you got to know these guys. I mean, you guys were going along very similar paths, and at some point you guys got to get together and hang out a little bit, got to know each other.
Well, quite a bit.
Yeah.
But way back from the 60s on, I mean, you know, the thing about the Beatles is they got it. They got what the Monkees was all about.
Yeah.
That pop sort of excursion into reality versus fantasy, that whole thing, they got it. John Lennon was the first one I remember ever saying they're like the Marx Brothers, and he was so right. I mean, that's...
Yeah.
In fact, the Monkees was a whole lot more about the Marx Brothers than it was the Beatles. Because on the television show, for instance, we were never famous. We were never successful. Whereas if you look at Hard Day's Night or Help, which are obviously wonderful movies, mm-hmm. the Beatles were famous. They were the Beatles, and they were successful, and they... And that's what it was about. But on the Monkey show, on the television show, we never made it. We were always struggling for success.
And yet the show, five decades later, still, you know, is so popular with just about every generation. You know, people love watching that show.
I think that is one of the reasons, is that it was about the struggle for success. And everybody, especially as a young teenager or early 20s, you're trying to carve out a space in the world, and that's what we were doing. We were struggling to make a living. I mean, it does beg the question of how we afforded a Malibu beach house when we never got any work.
Oh, that was the fun of the whole show. It was the fun of the whole show.
All right, it's a special edition of the Dave Plyer Show featuring the Groovy 60s. Up next is Barbara Eden of classic TV sitcom I Dream of Jeannie.
Jeannie, would you come in, please?
Oh, You love me.
Yes.
You were willing to risk your life with me.
Yes.
Oh, how could I have ever doubted you? You crazy, crazy cat.
Okay, that's enough.
Oh, yes, master. Instantly. Anything you wish.
Yep.
And do not worry. We do not have to get married. I will return to my bottle, and I shall be your genie, and you will be my master, and I will obey your every command.
Link me back to NASA.
Oh, yes, master. Instantly.
Hi, David. How are you?
I am excellent. I'm so glad that you're joining us tonight. And I will admit to having a big crush on you growing up.
Oh, you mean you don't still have it?
I still have it. Oh, no. I still have the crush. No, you know, we were talking before the interview that I had the pleasure of spending some time with you a few years ago when you were in Chicago. And you are just as lovely as ever.
Oh, well, thank you.
So how did the role of Jeannie come along?
Well, I had been reading about it in the trade magazines, you know, Variety Reporter, and reading about all these girls who were testing, and they were all very tall brunettes and beauty contest winners. I mean, Miss Italy, Miss Syria, Miss Israel, Miss Greece. You know?
So some exotic, yeah.
Yeah, and I thought, oh, well, that's not for me. Mm. And then my agent sent me a script one day, and I read it, and I thought, this sounds very familiar. And he called me that afternoon, and he said, did you read it? I said, yes. He said, did you like it? I said, I loved it. He said, well, they would really like you for that part, just like that. And I said, do they know what I look like? And he said, well, I don't know. They must, because they want you for the part. They've made an offer. But it's contingent upon you meeting Sidney Sheldon. He's lives in New York, and he's coming into town, and he'll be there tomorrow for tea at the Beverly Hills Hotel.
Nice.
I said, all right. And I went over, and I met Sidney, and we got along very well, and that's how I got the part.
Now, were you pregnant at the time of the pilot or right after?
No, it was after.
Okay.
It was after. It was quite a bit after. And the doctor actually gave me the news that I was pregnant, which I was thrilled. I was just over the moon. We had tried so long to have a baby. And then my agent called and said the show has sold on the same day.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, so that night I called Sidney and said, I have to talk to you, right now. And he was having dinner at someone's home, a well-known writer, I can't think of his name. Oh, Buck Henry.
Okay, oh, yeah.
Yeah, he's at Buck Henry's house, and he told me where to go, and I met him there, went into his little office at the side, and he looked at me and jokingly said, yeah, you're pregnant, like that. And I said, yes, and I can't do your show, with a big grin on my face.
Wow.
Which was terrible.
Yeah.
And he said, no. And I said, I'm sorry. I said, it just, this is unusual for us, but we're very happy that we're going to have a baby. And I was the luckiest girl in the world because Sidney and the studio worked very hard to get everything ready faster than they would have.
Mm-hmm.
And I did 13 shows pregnant.
In that costume. So I would have to think there was some pretty creative blocking or standing behind things.
Oh, that plus many, many scarves.
Oh.
I laughed. I used to call myself a walking tent. I flowed with scarves.
You know, if I had to think about it, I guess in the black and white episodes, the early episodes, you did have these long, very glamorous, like 5-foot scarves kind of flowing around.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
And I stood in back of a lot of chairs. And one time, it was funny, Gene Nelson was directing us, and he was a dear friend at the time. And his wife still is my good friend. But they had chosen a red bathing suit, a two-piece, for me to wear. And it was all set out there, and I looked at it, and I looked at Joey, the girl who was in charge of wardrobe, and I said, Joey, I can't wear that. And she said, well, just try it on. Let's see what it looks like. I put it on. It was horrible. It was just so embarrassing. I said, no, tell Jean I can't wear the bathing suit. I mean, God, I was 5 months pregnant. That's terrible.
Yeah, a little bit, yeah.
So Jean came running over to my dressing room and said, Barbara, you've never been a diva. What's the matter? And I said, well, I can't wear the bathing. I hadn't made a big deal out of it. You know, I just said no. Yeah. And I said, I can't wear it. I'm pregnant, Jean. I guess he'd forgotten. During all the shooting, and he said, well, put it on. I said, I'll put it on. I will not walk out in front of the crew. I said, you come here and see it. And he said, okay. So I put the thing on. I put a robe on over it, and when he came over to the door, I just flashed him. I opened it, and I said, see? And it closed to the can. And he went, oh, yeah, you're right.
That's great.
I think what they did was put me in a tire tube on my tummy.
Oh, that makes sense. Okay.
Yeah, on the side of the pool.
Yeah. Why not?
That was it.
Since so many of us have seen these episodes, Barbara, over and over throughout the years, you can tell that the cast had such great chemistry together.
Well, Larry and I were in sync. Even later, in later years, when we toured with Love Letters, it was like it was as though I was just at home with a family member, and I know he felt the same way. Our rhythms, our timing, everything was in sync.
Yeah, you've done plays together. You also did some Dallas together. I remember that also.
Yeah.
In the late 70s. And I know how much you enjoyed working with him, and you had a long lasting friendship. But at that time, you had some frustrations with him as well.
Well, not really. I didn't really. a lot of other people on the set did. Mm-hmm. He made things a little difficult for himself, really. And that, but it never affected me or our working together, ever.
More with TV icon Barbara Eden coming up next on 720 WGN. Dave Plyer on 720 WGN. We're talking to the legendary Barbara Eden of I Dream of Jeannie as we celebrate the groovy 60s. So how complicated was all the filming, given that special effects were nowhere near as advanced as they are today? I'm sure filming compared to a normal sitcom was way longer.
It was, and we couldn't have an audience,
right?
Because of the magic. And it was very complicated. When we were flying through the air, we were really flying through the air.
Exactly.
with wires attached, mm-hmm. things like that. A lot of green screen, which we had to adapt to. It didn't adapt to us. It was fun, though. I enjoyed it.
You know, it was a purely fun show. There are shows I used to love when I was a kid. You know, and I know some of you listening will agree, and you watch them now. And they're awful. I mean, seriously, like, I can't get through. You know, my kids were watching Gilligan's Island. I thought, well, I'm going to sit down and watch this or the monkeys. And I thought, this is going to be fun. And I got to tell you, it wasn't really that great. You watch Jeannie, and it is timeless as can be. It is funny as it was back then. And the slapstick, the comedy, the humor, the writing is just a joy to watch.
I'm so happy you think so.
Yeah, seriously. Seriously.
That makes me feel really good.
I bet. Now, I've heard you talk about the costume before, that it wasn't as revealing as you might think. It was, you know, people, and maybe that was a good thing, that, you know, you kind of led people to believe that it might be a little bit more revealing, but it really wasn't. And the press at the time made a bigger deal out of it than anyone else.
Well, it was a joke to begin with. It was a writer from the Hollywood Reporter, and he'd come on the set, and he'd say, do you have a belly button? And I'd say, Nicola Peek, you know. Things were very cheap then.
Yeah.
and so he'd started writing about it, just as a joke.
Yeah.
Does she or doesn't she have a belly button? And, of course, it peeked out every once in a while. It was there. The trousers were not up at the high waist. They were just sort of riding on my hips.
Yeah.
And then George Slaughter decided he wanted to premiere my navel on Laugh-In.
Right.
And the minute he told NBC that, everyone went, oh, MG, yeah. she has one? You know, can't show that. So I was not allowed to go on Laugh-In. I wasn't allowed. And they suddenly were very careful about my trousers. They lined the pantaloons.
Oh, jeez.
Which hadn't been lined before. They, you know, I had panties and long pantyhose on.
Yeah.
Both.
Yeah.
So, but no, they lined them.
Even more so. Wow. Well, I know the censors, they were pretty aware of this, too, because, you know, there was a story I've heard you tell, I think it was in your book, too, that about the smoke underneath the bedroom door.
Oh, yes, Larry.
Yeah.
Poor Larry. He had a scene, of course, where the bottle was in the bedroom.
Mm-hmm.
And was the bottle in the bedroom? No, it wasn't. It wasn't in the bedroom. But he locked me out, and I turned to smoke and went underneath the door. And you could hear Larry's voice, but not me. And he said, Jeannie! You know how he used to say.
Oh, yeah.
And then all of a sudden, the smoke came out from under the door. And it was funny.
Yeah.
Cute to see it.
I get it.
Happen.
Yeah.
But no, the censor said absolutely not. They cut that scene, and then they said no bottle in the bedroom.
Wow.
We hadn't even thought of taking the bottle in the bedroom before that. It's so funny.
Wow.
It's amusing.
It is. But I mean, obviously, the two characters got together, you know, and I know it kept it interesting that for so many years you weren't married. There was maybe some light flirting and all that. But at toward the end, they said, "Well, you know what? We're gonna bring these characters together and get married." Were you fond of that?
No.
Yeah.
No, I didn't think they should ever have been married. As I said before, she wasn't human.
Right.
Absolutely, was not human, and that was what was funny about the show. Was she was so convinced that she would be a person, a human person.
Sure.
Not a genie person.
Right.
And it just made her a housewife and That isn't what she was.
No, not at all. So what was your relationship like with some of the other supporting characters on the show? I know many, many of them are gone, but, you know, what was it like working on the set?
It was wonderful. It was just, you know, that was the happiest time of my life. At that moment, I had my baby, I had my work, and I enjoyed it. And everyone on that set was an angel.
I know you're still friends with Bill Daly. You still see him around
Yeah, I just saw Bill 2 weeks ago, actually.
Is that right?
Mm-hmm. He lives in New Mexico, but we see each other every once in a while at personal appearances and things.
That's so cool.
Mm-hmm.
That's so cool. How did you find out, and you shared the story with me before, how did you find out the series was canceled? Because, you know, today there's so many, you know, oh, it's the lead up to the final episode and all this other stuff. That's really not the way it was done back then.
Nobody told us anything.
Yeah.
No, we didn't know. The last day, I think, we knew. The last day of shooting.
Wow.
Yeah.
That it was just coming to an end, no fanfare, no final episode. It just
willowed away.
Yeah. I mean, it's kind of a shame. That's how they did it back then. Did you get any souvenirs from the set? Did you get, you know, any prop pieces? Like, was everything just the next day pretty much done?
Of course I did.
Yeah.
Of course I did.
You
got my bottle.
Okay.
You think I was going to leave that? Heavens.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, it's now in a safety deposit box.
Mm-hmm.
Because after the earthquake here, I thought,
smart.
We're not going to leave it on the shelf anymore.
No. Was the original, that was a Jim Beam bottle, wasn't it?
That is correct.
Yeah.
It was a Christmas bottle that year.
I have a very vintage bar in my house, like a 1960s bar, and it was green. I think there was green ones and red ones.
I didn't know they had red ones.
Yeah, they're red, and they had a little handle on them too, which was a little different. But there was like a pink one. It was almost like a pinkish red, and the green ones. And I had bought from somebody who's authorized through Sony, who hand painted these bottles. And when I had met you, I must have been 10 years ago. You were at WGN Television,
mm-hmm.
And I was there. And I have a picture of you and I and my bottle.
In your bottle.
That I have.
You just think it's your bottle. It's
well, it is your bottle. It is absolutely your bottle. Well, what's funny is after showing the kids the show last summer when we watched it so much, and they came up to my den where I do have it on a shelf high enough where nobody can get to it, my youngest, you know, I opened up the cork, and man, he was looking in there trying to see if he could find you. And they're like, he was...
Do you know, someone makes those bottles.
Yeah.
And sells them.
Yeah.
And he has one with the hole, the banquette, and the genie looking up at you.
Really?
Yeah, you turn the light on and you can see all the little things inside.
That's awesome. That is awesome. But you didn't get a costume.
No.
No.
No, I didn't. In fact, they would not let me have one.
That's awful.
It's too bad because they didn't take good care of them. And there aren't any there. I did a commercial for Lexus.
Remember that in the late 90s?
Yes, mm-hmm. And they copied the costume. So luckily I have that one.
Well, I saw you in an appearance with Bill Clinton.
Yeah, that's the one.
did you use it again? But I mean, I got to tell you something. You looked fabulous. I mean, if you look online, folks, you can see it on YouTube. It is amazing. You look fabulous. You still look fabulous. Oh, yes, you do. Oh, I got to tell you, you do. You absolutely do.
I really had to suck it up to do that. I was so nervous about wearing that costume.
Oh, you looked great. You really did. You looked fantastic.
Well, it was for a good cause.
Well, I Dream of Jeannie can be seen multiple times a day on Antenna TV, and I Dream of Jeannie, the complete series, is available on DVD. And for more on Barbara, and she's got a great website, too, visit BarbaraEden.com. Always a pleasure hanging
thank
out with you.
Thank you.
Always a pleasure.
Thank you. So nice. It's fun talking to you.
Well, thank you. And the pleasure is all mine. More of our special edition of the Dave Plyer Show, The Groovy 60s, after the news next here on 720 WGN.
Dave Plyer back with you on 720 WGN. So Adam West, the legendary actor who managed to keep his tongue in cheek while wearing the iconic cowl of the Cape Crusader on the 1960s classic TV series Batman, died back in 2017 at the age of 88. I spoke to Adam just a few years earlier about his legendary career and spent some quality time with our old chum.
Old chum.
I had to. I had
to. You really nailed that dialogue.
Thank you.
David, I couldn't have said it better than you did, believe me. That was the best introduction all day.
Excellent, excellent. I'm glad to hear that. Well, I know you read Batman comics as they came out when you were about 11 or 12 years old, and I know you're a comic book buff yourself. How did you know, at what time in your life did you say, hey, you know what, I want to become an actor?
Probably in my early 20s.
Okay, so it was really after college and everything that you said, yeah, you know, this is...
It really didn't happen earlier. I wanted to be in radio and TV and doing different things, and indeed I was for a while, but I never really concentrated or dreamed about being a bat.
Right, exactly.
Or anything similar.
Well, you did some radio. I know you did that. When you joined the Army, you also started some military TV stations on both coasts. And it was the mid-1950s that you joined your buddy when you were living in Hawaii, and you joined him on a local kid show.
Yes, there was a very successful morning show called the Kini Popo Show, which is Hawaiian for on the ball. And he did the show, and he did it well for several years, and then he decided to move on somewhere else, so I got to do the show in his place. And it was just a chimpanzee, actually, and me. Yes, a chimp named Peaches, who was really a guy in a diaper.
Oh, jeez. That makes
very
for
unusual.
No, it makes for good morning television. I was going to say, yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
But it happened so quickly, Adam, that when you started, you know, so many TV shows followed after that. You know, Maverick, Bonanza, Perry Mason, The Rifleman, The Detectives, Bewitched. You did movies. You did The Young Philadelphians with Paul Newman, The FBI Story with Jimmy Stewart, Tammy and the Doctor with Debbie Reynolds. And I might have seen you for the first time when I was really little in the Outlaws Is Coming with the original Three Stooges. You're a contract player for Warner Brothers, but you already had some really great exposure under your belt quickly.
Yes. I did all kinds of westerns and so on, different characters at Warner's. And then I did some very strange movies. For example, the one you mentioned, The Outlaws Is Coming with the Three Stooges.
But that was a classic, I got to tell you. I mean, people remember it. If they remembered any of those post-color Stooges movies in the 1960s, probably the most memorable one was that one, because we knew it was a young Adam West.
Well, and it was, a pretty big picture in color, and one of their last movies, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was. Okay, so now you're doing all this. How did you eventually get the role of Batman? How did that start, Adam?
They had seen a commercial that I did.
Nestle's Quick.
Yeah, Nestle's Quick, and I played a character called Captain Quick, and he was a spoof on James Bond, kind of tongue-in-cheek, and they said, that's the kid that could do Batman.
Wow. And the rest was history. Well, there was a Batman serial in the theater in the 1940s, a couple of them actually that were long forgotten. But I mean, they came and left pretty quickly. But this
I was too young to even see them.
Yeah, right. You were. And this TV series, though, introduced the character to really millions. I mean, this was the one that really put Batman on the map.
Yes. And it sold a lot of comic books, you know, really revived that comic book thing, and sold a lot of TV sets.
It did. Oh, it absolutely did. And it's amazing to me, because the comic books that were out back then were still kind of the classic comic books that we all grew up with. And it was only recently that Batman 66 came out from DC Comics that has your likeness in it. I mean, that's the first time I've ever seen it in a comic book like that.
Well, the happening more and more. And I think it's, you know, so much time has gone by. And as a senior superhero, this is a great tribute.
Absolutely is. And, you know, there's a Chicago connection to the beginnings of Batman on ABC. Yale Udoff, who was an ABC executive, attended a party at the Playboy Club in Chicago where they were playing the old serials that we were just talking about in the club.
Yeah.
And that gave him the idea to kind of push it, to take it to ABC and do something with it.
They were so attracted to it and amused by it that their hunch paid off.
It did. It absolutely did. Who decided to play the role of Batman in the series itself a little campier? Was it yourself? Was it William Dozier? Was it kind of a group decision that this is where we were going to take this series?
Well, we shaped the show as a social satire and a tongue-in-cheek comedy, really, for adults. And not for children, you know, they could enjoy all that other stuff. But as you got older, you caught the references and the gags. And I think it was Lorenzo Semple Jr. who wrote those first scripts, and our late executive producer, Bill Dozier, and myself. And we just got together and decided on a tone for the show.
Now, you did the pilot with Frank Gorshin as the Riddler. Did some of the fans, when the series first came out, did they expect it to be more serious, like Superman and the Lone Ranger, than what was portrayed?
Well, I think it probably did, and among certain people at the studio who didn't understand
right.
what we were doing.
Right.
And it took, you know, several months of just doing our thing to convince them.
Now, the show I know was going to be an hour-long show, but it was decided to split it up into two nights as a cliffhanger, which I don't think anyone has done even since then with a television series. It kind of brought back the old movie serials of, you know, you were kind of at the edge of your seat, and you didn't have to wait a whole week to get the ending.
Yeah, that was the homage to DC Comics and, the old comic books.
People watching the show, Adam, you know, they all wanted to ride in your Batmobile. They all wanted to slide down the pole from the library to the cave. It was every kid's dream that watched you on the show. And you had an amazing group of people that you got to work with as well. I know you've had a great friendship with Burt Ward over the years. He was a great on-air companion, wasn't he?
He really was. You know, he got it from the beginning. And he had this wonderful energy and curiosity and kind of excitement about him in the role, and it worked.
And there were the villains too, and that was, you know, there was a couple different.
They were great.
Yeah, they were, and there was a couple different. You know, there were the villains, the people walking on the walls when you were climbing the buildings. But let's talk about the villains. Burgess Meredith as the Penguin.
He was probably one of my three favorites. He was such a fine actor, and he brought so much comedy to it, you know, with that long cigarette holder and
right.
so on, and his attitude. He didn't need to spit out live fish. He was just erudite and a raconteur and terrific, yeah.
Cesar Romero is the Joker.
Yeah, great energy.
Great, absolutely. And then you had three Catwomen, both on the show and in the movie. You had Julie Newmar, you had Eartha Kitt, and Lee Merriweather, who did the movie version.
Wasn't Batman lucky?
I think there was a little crush on Julie Newmar.
Yeah.
That's what I'm thinking.
Well, it could have been. You know, she was with us the most.
Yeah. Yeah, but I think people look forward to certain villains on the show. I mean, just as a regular a viewer, you know, you got used to these villains. You got used to the actors that played them, and they all wanted to see this interaction with you.
Yes. You know, because the show was hot and fun and gave them a chance to play characters certainly bigger than life and very colorful, you know, everyone wanted to do it.
Adam, again, a thrill for me and I'm sure our listeners to have the opportunity to spend some time with you tonight.
Well, David, thank you very much. I mean, you've been remarkable in your observations. I appreciate it.
Absolutely. Thank you again.
You bet, David. You too.
All right. Much more ahead on 720 WGN.
Rock and Roll Hall of Famer Darlene Love began singing lead vocals for legendary producer Phil Spector,
While still in high school, cutting such classics as the number one He's a Rebel, the Do Run Run, and the holiday classic Christmas Baby Please Come Home. She sang back up with the likes of Dionne Warwick, the Mamas and the Papas, Elvis, and Sonny and Cher. She's done Broadway, the movies, and headline concert tours worldwide. And joining us tonight to talk about her iconic career is a legendary Darlene Love.
Good evening to you.
Oh, so great to talk to you. You know what? Your career and getting into music started at such a young age for you. You were listening to gospel music, you know, when you were just a kid.
Right. I was brought up on gospel music. My father was a minister, and he had a church where he was a pastor, and I have four siblings, and when you have five children, they belong in the choir.
Well, of course they do. Of course they do.
And everything else that has anything to do with church.
Yeah, I would think so. I would think so. And that's really, you know, that was your first audience, was the church congregation.
That was my first audience. It was them. And that's a tried and true, because they don't tell you right away whether you were good or anything.
No, but the greats, including yourself, always talk about Aretha Franklin, about all, you know, what they learned and what they grew up in was through the church and gospel music. I mean, that is probably, you know, the most inspirational, obviously, genre of music that's out there.
It is, and all of it comes from there. That's where it started. I mean, with the pianos and the guitars and tambourines and, you know, all of that was in church, you know. So to come out and do it, it just was part of our lives.
You joined the Blossoms, which originally started as the Dreamers in the early 50s. It was a Capitol Records group, I believe.
Yes.
And this young, talented woman named Darlene Wright, if you remember who she was.
Yes.
you replaced one of the singers that was, you know, one of the original singers, but there was never a lead in the Blossoms or the Dreamers. You became the lead singer.
Right, because when I got in that group, they had a vocal coach who was their manager, and he mostly taught them songs where you sung four-part harmony, rather, like the McGuire sisters, you know, mm-hmm. Sincerely. That's the kind of songs he taught them. So when I got with the group, they made me their lead singer when they heard me sing. So when we got ready to record our first record for Capitol Records, they just said, well, you're going to be the lead singer.
Well, then you also recorded under the group The Ronettes, too, and some other uncredited songs. All this uncredited stuff, what was Spector's philosophy behind all of this? Was it about his just music machine and what he wanted to do, I would assume, rather than the artists themselves?
He cared more about the lead singer than he did anything, you know. But when I say he cared about the lead singer, it didn't matter whether it was me singing for the Crystals. The Ronettes did all their singing, but we did most of their background, just like Bobby Sox and the Blue Jeans. He cared about his music and how it was going to come out just about as much as he cared about the lead singer. You know, he took hours and hours just to lay the tracks down, you know, and the background voices.
Well,
you know, and that was such a big part of his records, meaning, and that's where they came from, that tagged him, you know, the wall of sound.
Right, exactly. And I mean,
overdubbed.
Yeah, and it was a machine. It was yeah. Really a machine. But now, finally, you know, your name got featured also as the artist is Today I Met the Boy I'm Gonna Marry.
Right.
Which was an absolute classic as well. And you provided backup at that time. You did it for some big names. And here's ones that I was very surprised about. Doris Day and Patty Duke. Those were two names that just don't fall.
The Blossoms were very fortunate. We were really blessed to be where we were during that time, because we met every young producer that came along. Terry Melchner, who was Doris Day's son, recorded her for the movie Move Over Darling. So he said, well, why not use the Blossoms to do the background for this song? So that's how we got to be, you know, such huge background singers in the business, because we knew all the new producers who were coming along at the time and the producers who were trying to make a name for themselves. So Adler.
It provided great exposure to all these people.
And then we got to know them as friends. You know, we even friends today. So it's a life lesson that we, you know, learned while we were working with all of them.
What did Elvis suggest to you one day on the set of his movie Change of Habit? Share that with the audience, will you?
It's so long ago. It's amazing. We actually did Change of Habit. the movie Change of Habit with Elvis. And you take a break, you take a dinner break, and everybody went on. And I had left my sunglasses in my dressing room, and I went back to get them. And I told the girls, I'll catch up with you. And on the way back, Elvis saw me walking by, and he said, well, oh, come in here. And I thought maybe he had this thing, he would always pull out his guitar and just start singing gospel music, which was great. But the girls were usually all around during that time. And so, no, he said, come in. No, I'd like to talk to you. And I went, okay. So I went in, and very rarely is Elvis by himself. I mean,
yeah,
all
entourage.
Of his boys, everybody is always around him. That,
sure.
That was really a surprise for me. And when I walked into the dressing room, he said, you know, I've always thought about, you know, having an affair with a black woman, you know. And I said, oh, really? And I said, well, you're not going to have it with me.
That's awesome.
And it was funny because we're doing just what we do, me and you are doing right now. We laughed at it. He says, okay, I'll see you after lunch.
Yeah, bye-bye.
And we all went on out. I went shaking out of his dressing room to meet the girls and couldn't wait to tell them what had happened.
I bet. Now, here's the one thing I'm kind of ashamed about, because I didn't know this back then. And maybe, again, it was because you said that Spector didn't use your picture a lot of who you were. And I think it was a couple reasons, too. I think it was also because, you know, a lot of the group members came in and out, and they weren't as steady. And so he just probably didn't want to put names and faces on there. But I did not know until probably just a few years ago that you were Danny Glover's wife in the Lethal Weapon films. I had no idea. I'm like, oh, my God, that's her.
I got a lot of new young fans when I did those movies, which was great.
Absolutely.
She said, you know, they knew me as an actor, and they was like, oh, my God. I said, no, I'm a singer. I sing these songs. And they went, you mean you sing, too? I said, yes, I act, too. I'm a singer.
But that was probably off of Broadway. I mean, they saw you act, they saw you sing, and they yeah, that is absolutely incredible. And they were great movies, too, and so fun watching you in them. Now, looking at them, and when I'm watching them on cable at 1 o'clock in the morning, they show up, I'm like, oh, my gosh, that is her. That is Darlene Love.
That's truly amazing.
Yeah, it's a lot of fun. We're celebrating the groovy 60s on the Dave Plyer Show, and there's more after the top stories from the Northwestern Medicine Newsroom next here on 720 WGN. It's Dave Plyer on 720 WGN. Bill Mumy is a multi-talented, prolific artist who entered the arena of professional entertainment at the age of 5. He's best known by fans around the world for the creation of his memorable role as the heroic boy astronaut Will Robinson on the classic TV series Lost in Space. Bill has appeared on over 400 television programs, 18 theatrical films. He is also a voiceover artist, musician, and to talk about it all is Bill Mumy. Bill, welcome in, my friend.
Well, thank you kindly, Dave. It's nice to be here.
Well, I want to talk a little bit about on how you got into acting at such a young age. I know you watched a lot of Zorro. You watched a lot of Superman growing up. You loved comic books. Guy Williams, who played your father in Lost in Space, by the way, was on Zorro. It made you want to do something adventurous, and television became something you really wanted to be a part of at a very young age.
Well, I couldn't have said it better myself. That's true. What really was the catalyst for it actually becoming a reality was I broke my leg when I was 4 years old, and I broke my leg playing Zorro. But for, you know, 8-10 weeks, I was unable to run outside and play with my friends, so I was pretty much stuck to watching television all day, and I was a little red-haired kid in West Los Angeles who really wanted to get inside the TV. So my dad said to my mom, well, you know, if you go with him and check it out, and if it makes everybody happy, go ahead. And pretty soon I was working very prolifically.
Well, I know, you know, I thought this was a very cool idea. Your mom said, okay, we're going to take you down to a local romper room, and to see if you're comfortable even being in front of a camera. So she was dipping her toe in it. She was being very cautious. And obviously, it's something that you love doing. You did a couple of them. And I just remember as a kid, and I grew up in the late 60s, so I discovered a lot of these shows in reruns and so forth. But it'd be like, hey, wait a minute, there he is again. Like, you had a lot of great roles on some of the biggest shows of the 60s.
I did, and I'm very grateful for that. And I'm also really glad that my parents and my agent at the time, they really made a conscious effort to say, after things started going, to say, look, one week he's doing a drama in a Hitchcock. The next week he's doing a sitcom with Ozzie Nelson, or he's doing a Western on Have Gun Will Travel, or he's playing a sick kid on Dr. Kildare or Ben Casey, or he's making a Disney movie. Let's not put him in a television series. Why should he
be one of
five characters on a sitcom where he comes in with a baseball and, you know, eats a cookie and then goes up to his room to do homework?
He's so true.
He's having this, you know, I really had a wonderful education as an actor working in all those different arenas of style and tone, and working with some of the most legendary directors and iconic stars, whether it's Lucille Ball or Jimmy Stewart or, I mean, all those people. I learned so much, and I got to play so many different types of characters that it was a great, great training ground. And when Lost in Space eventually came along, which was 5 years and change after I had started working, that was exactly what I had wanted to do in the first place. I mean, to me, Will Robinson was a little superhero.
Sure.
You know, he could fly a ship, he could program the robot, he was a good shot with a laser gun, he had a little, you know, space suit and a Flash Gordon suit. I mean, what kid wouldn't want to do that?
Well, Bill, in the early days of Lost in Space, it took a little time, but the focus quickly pivoted to Will Robinson, Smith, and the robot.
It's funny, isn't it, how certain shows end up revolving around a trinity. You know, whether it's Bones and Spock and Kirk, or whether it's Luke Skywalker and R2-D2 and C-3PO, somehow or another, Lost in Space became that trinity of Smith, the robot, and Will Robinson. And I had no problem with that. You know, it was great working with Jonathan and Bobby Day, and I loved having a lot to do. But I always favored the earlier episodes of the show, tone-wise, because they were darker and they felt more realistic.
They were in black and white, weren't they?
Yeah, we had a great cinematographer the first season named Gene Polito, and his black and white stuff, wait till you see it on the Blu-ray. It looks beautiful. I mean, it looks as good as, like, Frankenstein or one of the great 30s movies. It's really well lit and shadowy. But the show certainly placed in what was called a family hour by the network. PBS originally aired the show at 7:30 to 8:30 on Wednesday nights, and they demanded that there be nothing in the show that would scare little kids. And in the first few episodes, you know, it's actually quite not that way. It is pretty scary.
Yeah, right.
And they start getting some phone calls and some complaints that it was too scary for the family hour. So the network mandated that the show tone lighten up. And that was when Jonathan Harris also very wisely realized that if he continued to play the character of Dr. Smith as a saboteur, snarling villain who was actually out to sabotage children and everything, he'd quickly be off the show. They'd kill him off or something. So he started to sneak in a little more of the comedy into his work, and both the network and Irwin Allen, our producer, came to him and said, know what you're doing, do more of it. And also, it was 1965, what a global revolution there was in terms of entertainment. You know, the Beatles were in high gear, folk rock was kicking in, you were just on the burgeoning reality of psychedelia, you know, Richard Nixon was on Laugh-In, you had Batman coming on, which was actually on the same time as Lost in Space. It was very high camp, and we kind of just joined that pop art, that brief period in you know, history that's a really unique time.
Thank you, Bill.
Oh, I really appreciate it. It's been a nice time, and obviously you've tickled my ego, and I appreciate that. And thanks to all the fans for over 50 years who have, you know, kept me going.
Well, thank you. It's always you pop up on television constantly. You're watching antenna TV. You're all over the place. It's always a pleasure to see you.
Well, thanks. I got around.
You did get around. Thanks again, Bill. I appreciate it.
Okay, cheers.
Cheers to you. All right, much more ahead on 720 WGN. All right, we are celebrating the groovy 60s on the Dave Player Show here on 720 WGN. And up next is my conversation with the late Don Wells of 60s TV sitcom Gilligan's Island. While the series starred Bob Denver, Alan Hale, Jim Backus, Natalie Schaefer, Tina Louise, and Russell Johnson, Dawn radiated all-American wholesomeness, Midwestern practicality, and a youthful, naive charm as the character of Marianne.
Just sit right back and you'll hear a tale of a fateful trip that started from this tropic port aboard this tiny ship. The mate was a mighty sailing man.
Hello, hello, hello. You know, it really is. I mean, good girl sounds like goody two-shoes. But, you know, when we were when we first got stranded on the island, the birth control pill wasn't even invented.
It wasn't.
So imagine if you drop Marianne today with Miley Cyrus on the piano top, topless or whatever's going on. Wow, what an adjustment.
You would have had to use a coconut. I don't know what you would have used. I mean, you were very they were very inventive, the writers back then.
Yes, they were. And we were pretty good that I could make a coconut cream pie with no cow.
That's right, right, right. That's true. That's right. True. Now, I grew up in the 70s, and I discovered the show in reruns here on WGN Television in Chicago. And the choice between Marianne and Ginger was always very easy for me because Ginger just seemed way, way, way too high maintenance, like just way too much trouble. It was always Marianne for me.
Well, don't you think maybe it's your age? I mean, don't you think maybe if you were 30 or something and wanted to go out rock and rolling or dancing or buying a cocktail, it would be a Ginger?
No.
I don't know. So
mm-mm.
I was very impressed mm-mm. because she was a movie star. And, you know, I'd seen Gods of the Lake that she did with Rock Hudson, and I was, wow, we have this beautiful movie star on the island. And yet, the question always is Marianne or Ginger, and I don't mean to be egotistical, but I usually always win. But
you
I would
do.
Have been your best friend, too, you know. I would cook, I would clean, I'd go to the Boy Scout meeting with you, we'd go to prom. I mean, I think there was a, she'd be your friend.
So how did you get your role on Gilligan's Island, Dawn?
Well, I don't know how long after I came to Hollywood I came along, because I was doing a lot of work. But there was a call out for, there were three replacements. It were three school teachers, I think, and CBS said, fine, but let's rewrite. So they created a Ginger, a professor, and a Marianne. And I was just one of the 4,000 girls that went up for Marianne. And we tested at CBS Television City, and we tested with both Gingers and Marianne all day long for about 5 days. Every ingenue, every sex symbol were all there, and they tried to match with even the professor. Russell used to tell me, the vice president used to say to him, Russell, take off your shirt. No, I'm not going to take off my shirt. So I think they were looking for muscle men, too. I don't know what they were looking for.
Yeah.
But it went on for a week, and I got the part. You know, I don't know. I was lucky, but I also am a perfect type, and I say that to students. I was very well trained. I knew my craft, but I also looked like a Marianne.
Yeah.
You know, Ginger, no matter how good she be, could be as an actress, you would never cast her as a Marianne.
Right, right.
So that physical stuff does make a difference, I think.
Sure. Now, at first season, you were just credited at the beginning as The Rest.
And yes, I'm still The Rest. No. Yeah, and the professor and I used to send each other cards, love The Rest. But after the first year, and I don't know who takes the credit. Gilligan took the Bob took the credit. One of the directors took the credit, and Sherwood said, this is silly. There's seven people on an island. So they rewrote the credits. But I wasn't uptight about that.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't have that kind of an ego. You do your job and you do the best you can, and you can't manipulate the business. You don't know what's going to happen.
But what's funny is because we all grew up with three channels back then, is that
yes.
The large amount of audience that saw that show compared to today. I mean, you know, it's so, you know, diverse on all the entertainment that you can have. But back then, and even in the 70s and in the early 80s through the reruns, I mean, you know, the communal experience of watching some of these shows and growing up with them, you recognize stuff like that because you saw these episodes 500 times.
That's right. And the whole family watched it together.
Yeah.
And I look at it and I still laugh because we really had a talented cast.
Yeah, yeah.
And it blended perfectly. I mean, the casting was perfect and each character was so specific. You know, a lot of the shows, we had the Partridge Family and the Monkees and Father Knows Best and all of that, but it was so unique that we were on this island with all these clothes and coconut cream pies.
Yeah, it was a different type of story than the usual family, you know, sitcom. Tell me about your relationship with some of the folks on the cast. Tell me about Bob Denver.
He was an incredible guy, very, very, very smart.
Yeah, you're close to him.
And he was very, very selective. Very few people were invited to his home. He was very, very private, and Bob and I just really connected. He was a genius at what he did. And I'm going to ask you this question because I sure you don't know the answer. I think sometimes when you're a genius in whatever category you are, you're not necessarily gregarious or trivial conversation is a bore, blah, blah, blah. Well, do you know who Charlie Chaplin's best friend was?
Uh-uh.
Albert Einstein.
Really?
And that, yeah, and I was doing some research for doing a historical thing I was doing, and I went, wow, but think of the two brains together.
Right.
I mean, they're both geniuses in whatever they do, but yet they found each other. And I really think that Bob, he did Maynard, G. Krebs, that. But not only, there wasn't a lot of wit in what Bob did in Gilligan's Island. It was physical.
Yeah.
Falling out of trees and tripping and all of that. And I look at his little body now when I watch it and think, oh, my gosh, he was so limber about everything he did. And yet he was into no pesticides. I'd say, Bobby, you look so tired today. What happened? He said, well, I had to name a spider farm last night. We had a spider farm, and we had to name all the spiders. So he was very in tune with kids. And I think that's what the soul of Gilligan came through.
Sure. Absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, it was such a fun, whimsical character that everybody kind of embraced and grew up with. What about Alan Hale?
Oh, he was a doll, and he was the same size as my father.
Is that right?
Every time he'd hug me, he'd kind of pick you up off the floor. You know, he was a great big jovial. Never saw him angry, never saw him temperamental. The professor and I were very close because we were and the rest. We send each other cards, love the rest all the time. But he had a great sense of humor. Actually, you think of Jim Backus, but in between takes, Russell was the funniest. The professor was the funniest.
What about Jim and Natalie? The Howells.
Oh, they were hysterical. I mean, Natalie and I were very close, and she was very much a character. Very much a character. Jim, for a comedian who don't usually share your humor, he'll say, Natalie, try it this way, you'll get a bigger laugh. Or sure, put a word with a K in it, it gets a bigger laugh. And at one point, Natalie said, every time we come off of the scene, Jim is just doing all this ad-libbing, and I don't know what to do. So Jim taught her how to ad-lib. And if you see the later episodes, they're both trying to outdo each other, coming out of the hut trying to ad-lib.
That's awesome. That's
but he
awesome.
Was very cheap. He had a lot of money. But he would ask Natalie and I know you read the book, but he would ask Natalie
yes.
and I to go to lunch. Then we go to lunch, and at the end of it, he'd say, oh, I forgot my credit card. I don't have my wallet. And at the end of the first season, Natalie presented him with
a bill.
With
a bill, yes.
You're at lunch, Jim. And I don't think he ever paid her either.
Right. How about Tina Louise?
Well, Tina, you know, I was in awe because she was a beautiful, beautiful woman. And she knew what camera angle she wanted, and she ordered us the false eyelashes from New York. And she was glamorous all the time. And I don't say I envied that, but I was in awe of it. She was a little reserved, I guess. I think she really thought that it might have been more of a show about Ginger.
Mm-hmm.
I never saw a temper tantrum. I never saw any conflict with anything. But she was a little removed.
But then here's what I loved is there came the reunion movies and the rescue from Gilligan's Island. And it was one of the highest rated made-for-TV movies at that time. How fun was it getting
yes.
back together? Was it almost surreal? Like, oh, my God, we're going to do this all over again?
Yes, and some of the plots were stupid. Harlem Globetrotters, and I mean, some of that stuff. And they come in and play basketball and leave and don't know where they were. You know, I mean, that's about as close to reality as you can get, you know? But no, it was fun, and we're so happy to see each other. And when we came back, I don't know if you remember the episode, but the whole hut floated in to Santa Monica Pier.
Yeah, you tied all the huts 5, together.
People that, yeah, tied them all together.
But see,
I mean, how...
But see, after watching it for all those years and watching all the reruns, even a decade later, you know, it was cool to have some closure. You wanted to know how they were finally going to get off that island.
Yeah, and it would really kind of been that kind of neat to have us all go back to where we came from and see if you would adjust. But,
yeah.
Of course, that's too esoteric to even think about.
And that was the late Dawn Wells on the legacy of TV sitcom Gilligan's Island. We're celebrating the groovy 60s on the Dave Plyer Show, and there's more after the top stories from the Northwestern Medicine Newsroom. Next here on 720 WGN.
All right, it's Dave Plyer on 720 WGN. So Saturday Night Live may have debuted on NBC in October 1975, but much of its roots originated from the network's Laugh-In, which premiered January 22nd, 1968. Surrounded by sets decorated with go-go dancers, cocktail parties, and joke walls, a young, cute, happy, and fun cast delivered a new blueprint for generating laughter. Now, throughout his long and successful career as a producer and writer, George has been responsible for hundreds of hours of television series and specials. He, of course, changed the face of television when he created and produced Laugh-In. And to talk about this legendary series, George Schlatter joins us tonight. Good evening, George.
Hi, how are you? Thanks for the nice words.
Absolutely. Thrilled to have you join us. It was Rowan and Martin's Laugh-In, and I know you knew Dan and Dick for years before that show. There was definitely magic with them. But why did you choose them?
Well, the show was originally designed did not have a host. It just happened. And Timex, Jim Ellis at Timex, said he would do the show, but he wanted to have a host. So I'd worked with Dan and Dick, and so we went to them. They wore tuxedos, and they were a little older than the rest of the people, and they became the center. They became the post around which everything kind of revolved. And they were older, and they liked the idea of all of these young comics who were character comics. Artie Johnson did voices, and Ruth Buzzi did all of these characters, and Lily Tomlin did characters. Well, this show, the design of this show with all of these bits and pieces and brief little vignettes was perfect for the talent that did multiple characters. So Lily Tomlin could do 6, 8, 10 characters in one show. So could Ruth Buzzi and Artie Johnson. And but it was a bizarre collection of people with these little bursts of crazy things.
You know, you talk about sponsors, and some of our younger listeners might not really get that, but I mean, the sponsors drove the car, man. They drove the train. If you had to please them in whatever you were doing, really for the first 20 plus years of television, it was all about the sponsor.
Yes, it was. Yes, it was. And but this, for the sponsors, we could do sponsor jokes, and we could do jokes. We had integrated the sponsors into the show, and it broke a lot of rules. We had rules then just would go on for days, and a woman by the name of Carolyn Raskin invented much of the editing techniques that allowed us to do laughing with these little short pieces because we didn't have the technology that we have today. And so we just put it together. She put it together in these little bursts. And we ran it for the network, and they said, but that's not a television show. We said, no, but you laughed, and the audience is brighter than you are. So they put it on, and nothing happened because there were no names on the show. You know? It was all just these little young character people. And but it caused quite a stir, and eventually when it went on the air after 3 or 4 weeks, it just kind of exploded. And the audience was ready for something new and unique, and nothing had happened other than just pretty much theater and nightclub style of comedy. And so when this came on, the audience was waiting for something different, and this was it.
Yeah, that was it. Well, and you were up against, I was looking at what you were up against at that time, and you pretty much were in the same Monday night time slot for the entire time, which is pretty unusual, too.
That was a big battle we had with NBC. NBC said they wanted to put it on later so there wouldn't be as many problems because we had trouble with censors and sponsors and so forth. Sure. And I just wouldn't do it later, so it stayed on Monday night at 8 o'clock.
Yeah.
And it was appointment television.
It was. You were up against Gunsmoke and Here's Lucy. I mean, big ratings.
Well, the one other thing, it was Gunsmoke and Lucy were number one and number two.
Right.
And NBC had nothing to put on Monday night at 8 o'clock.
No. And Jeannie was your lead-in. I think Jeannie.
Cannon fodder. Yeah. They put us on knowing that nothing would happen, but they had nothing else that they wanted to put on that they were willing to sacrifice. So we went on the air, and nobody really gave us much of a glance, even though I had no hope at all. But after the third week or so, people began to talk about it. And then Sammy Davis came on and did Here Come the Judge. And
exploded.
It just took off.
Yeah, it did. Even though, you know, you talk about how edgy and contemporary that show was, it looked very current, of course, for the time. But it also seems like you took some inspiration from earlier variety shows, some of the vaudeville shows, when you were putting this together, because it was such a mishmash of talent.
Yeah, it was. It was. But I'd grown up and worked a lot in saloons with the comics that were doing it. You know, but they were all stand-up comics. But we didn't have any way at that point to put them together. So we put them all together, and we taped and taped and taped, and then edited. Carolyn Raskin edited all of that together, and it came out as television for the, not for the blind, but for the attention challenged.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
And it, but it was a delight to do because we came into the studio and we could do anything we wanted to and for as long as it worked. And then we came in with a big script and we would tape everything, and then Carolyn Raskin would put it all together. And some of the early shows were a real adventure, and nobody could really understand what we were doing, including me. But it was just my own short attention span and a wonderful British writer by the name of Digby Wolfe. And then when you took Artie Johnson and Ruth Buzzy and Joanne Worley and Goldie Hawn and Lily Tomlin, those people, and you put them all into the studio, then we would come in with a script, and then we would also play. If anything happened, we kept it in. So when we got all through, it was 1 hour of just a bunch of adult children.
George, I have to tell you, what a great pleasure it has been spending some time with you.
I've enjoyed this. Listen, take a look at the show and let me know what you think.
I'll do that.
You got to be sure you're sitting down and shut down the phone.
Focused.
Don't have anything in it. Don't tell your children not to interrupt you and kind of pay attention to it. I think you'll enjoy it.
I'm sure
even,
I will,
Hopefully you'll understand a lot of it.
I'm sure I will. I'm sure I will. Can't wait to see it, sir.
Thank you.
All right. We'll be right back after this on 720 WGN.
All right, it's Dave Plyer on 720 WGN, and as we wrap up our celebration of the 1960s, up next is comedy legend Dick Smothers. The Smothers Brothers Comedy Hour was one of the most controversial shows on television, and in 1969, because of their opposition to war, support of civil rights, and tweaking authority, CBS abruptly yanked them from the air. But for over 50 years, these masters of satire, pioneers of improv, and just your average pair of bickering siblings, Dick and Tom Smothers are comedy treasures.
Hey, it's great to be on your show.
I am thrilled that you're joining us. You are a legend in comedy, and I was mentioning to you before the call, my sister and I had this album we discovered, I think when we were like 7, 8 years old, called The Golden Hits of the Smothers Brothers, Volume 2, and we must have played that album 50 times, and still today, and I listened to it yesterday, still today, every single bit of it stands up.
Well, thank you. Thank you. Did you ever search for volume one?
Yeah, that's the funny thing. So I was like, no, I did. And then I just realized, okay, there's the joke. There is no volume one. That's fantastic.
Yeah, when we released the Time Life videos of the Smothers Brothers Comedy Hour, we started with the third season. And they said, well, why do you want the third? I said, because they'll be so bored by end of the first season, they won't want to see what happens next.
That's brilliant. No, that's brilliant.
So, I don't know how brilliant it is, but we were short on material, but long on timing and being in the right point in history with the right mentality. And my brother Tommy was born in a delightful, damaged fashion, like we all are. That's what makes us unique. You know, we have these little defects and assets, and they don't go across the board. If you're smart in math, like Einstein, I understand. One time he left the house to get on the train to go to work, and he forgot his pants. So you know, but he was not a dumb guy that kept forgetting pants. It's just that, well, Tommy has dyslexia. Is part of it. He's really deep, smart guy, and our sensitivities when the 60s happened, and really important, the Kingston Trio had popularized folk music, and it really hit like nothing else in the colleges, young people. And that was in time and that was in the late 50s. Then the 60s came in, and all the civil discourse and the drugs pot, civil rights, all that stuff was in place. Tommy and I were so blessed that Tommy, I keep saying blessed. Everybody was blessed. The same era we lived there. But the there were story songs around, like Tom Dooley, John Henry, all that stuff. That and folk music came out with that really hit songs in the early 50s with the Weavers, Pete Seeger, Beautiful Brown Eyes, Goodnight Irene. They were top hits. They didn't relate to any group, social group, ethnic group or anything. They were just there. And then when the youth came in and they really for the first time had something to say and nowhere to say it, we happened to have a TV show that related to them, and we filled it with young writers and people that could connect with the counterculture and all the stuff that was happening, you know, pot, war, the draft, civil rights, you name it. And by accident, we were the right people to fill a time slot on Sunday night at 9 o'clock opposite Bonanza, which was a dark hole. I don't know if a lot of your audience realize or think about it, that if you were watching a show at 9 o'clock, there was two other shows you could not tape or
right.
could record.
Right.
Could not record. Yeah. You missed them.
No, Bonanza was number one, and it was unbeatable, really, at that time.
It was terribly unbeatable.
Yeah.
And by accident, they just because William Morris, our agency, talked to CBS and to say, you got to have some younger hosts. You know, you're aging. Your team is, the players on your field are aging, like a football team. Let's get some young people. And it happened to be that time, and we were in place in our career, that they picked us. And it was like a suicide mission, but Tommy says, well, what the hell? We can't lose. Everybody is not successful here, so we could only be like everybody else, but we could maybe do something, and we'll have our own show. How many times are you offered your own show?
But now you have complete creative control handed over to you.
Reluctantly, they said that, and then they took it back.
Right,
that
right,
was another
right.
thing.
Well,
they
course.
Thought we were going to fail, of course. But think of the great people that predated us. Jack Benny and George Burns, two of my favorite. What was the premise of their shows? They were both married, and they were at home.
And that was
they
it.
Were themselves.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
That's what they did.
Yeah.
You know? And so so what happened was, it had that time slot was really dire for CBS to fill it up. They were... The spot when we went against Bonanza in this that season, the 66 season,
yeah.
They were rated at the most watched hour of the week.
Right.
It was Sunday night at 9 o'clock. More TV sets turned on, which was important. And they rated 90th or something. They were the last. You know how much money they were losing for advertising.
Okay.
So they were really in desperate needs, desperate. And so why not? A variety show is quick to put together. It's less expensive than film, and we could do it right now. And so they said, okay, the Smothers Brothers. And we were very safe then. That all that civil rights stuff and the counterculture was fermenting.
Yeah, it was developing.
In the early 60s,
right,
yeah.
Right, right.
And we had short hair, big ears, Middle West stuff. Their daddy was a war hero. They sing folk songs. What can go wrong? Or what could go right? They'll probably be in and out, and we'll work on something with substance. And Michael Dann, one of the executives at CBS in charge of variety shows and specials and stuff, took a big leap and really was our champion. And he changed the direction. Not only did we change what television could put on a family viewing hour, not unbeknownst to us, variety show was being phased out, except for Ed Sullivan.
Mm-hmm.
It really wasn't variety. It was a vaudeville show, a really great one. And they were canceling all the Red Skelton. They were canceling Dan Kay and all the older people.
Sure.
And it turned around. It was so hot. And by the way, our show was not unique. It was just a regular variety show. It was the elements and the execution and who we booked on the show.
Absolutely.
That made it unique.
Topical,
yeah.
Edgy,
so,
not only unique, but relevant. I think that's...
Yeah, we were really relevant. Now, Carol Burnett was 2 weeks away from being hired for that show.
Wow!
And they wouldn't have lost her. They had an option on her. That the option was running out 2 weeks after they booked us on the show. Now, say they chose Carol Burnett, it never would have been the same.
Right.
I think they would have been very successful. That was the most brilliant three-wall show ever, ever.
Yeah,
the cast, it cut ours 18 ways, but it wouldn't have driven any political
Mm-mm,
new
no.
boundaries.
No.
It wouldn't have opened doors. So that's why we were maybe with Isaac Newton, we discovered one thing. He discovered gravity, and we've been talking about it ever since.
Comedy legend Dick Smothers. That wraps up our special edition of the Dave Pleyer Show, The Groovy 60s.